Okay, so welcome to the first Siddha class for 2012. And so from now on, we do each Siddha class on the edge of a knife because we don't know when the world's going to end. Oh, okay. Well, in a case where we're fully confident that we can proceed until that such a time. Okay, very good. Okay. Okay, so we're all counting down for that. Yeah. We will definitely. That is a very good idea. Yes, we'll definitely aim to finish the Majjhima Nikaya before the world ends. That would be very suitable. Yeah. Yeah. He says without too much confidence. Yeah. Okay, so we're having a look this week at Majjhima Nikaya, sutta number 121. Chula Sunyata Sutta, which is one of the two suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, which deal with the concept of emptiness, translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi following the Anamoli as voidness, or most people prefer emptiness. And of course, this being a sutta of some interest and some importance because the teaching on emptiness is typically one of the teachings which often in emphasis distinguishes the philosophy of Theravada from the Mahayana and the northern philosophers. So the northern traditions often emphasize emptiness a lot more, and you don't hear emptiness being spoken of nearly so much in the Theravadan tradition, to the extent that people sometimes ask whether there is any teachings on emptiness in the Pali Canon. So this sutta shows, of course, that there are teachings on emptiness in the Pali Canon, and like most things found in the Mahayana sutras, we can find precursors for it in the Pali Canon. But again, like many things in the Mahayana sutras, the way it's treated in the Pali Canon is a little bit different. Actually, this is one area where there is already a difference between not just the Pali and the later and the Mahayana sutras, but also between the Pali sutras and the other Agama sutras, the early Buddhist scriptures in Chinese and other translations. And typically we find that whereas in the Pali scriptures we almost invariably have the three characteristics of existence, which is anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent suffering and not self. In the suttas, especially of the Sarvasivadin group of schools, we regularly find four characteristics, often known as the four seals of existence. These are not seals in the sense of being large aquatic mammals. These are seals in the sense of being things with which everything in the world is marked, like a seal on a letter or something like that. So the seals of existence are the impermanent suffering, not self, and emptiness. And you'll often hear these referred to, especially in Tibetan Buddhism. And the Tibetans took them largely from the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma. So there is this difference in, certainly a somewhat of a difference in emphasis between early Buddhist and later Buddhist teachings. The way of emphasizing emptiness can be discerned historically through the evolution of the Abhidharma texts and so on, and we looked last year at Nagarjuna and how he treated emptiness, and in that discussion we noticed how he referred in some cases to suttas from the Sarvasivadin Agamas, which there's no direct parallel for in the Pali. So that there's this kind of slight distinction in the even in the early scriptures in this way emptiness is treated, which kind of blows up because of the way that it's emphasized in the later by the later philosophers, until it becomes quite a major difference. A pattern which, curiously enough, for somebody who wants to investigate the doctrinal history of these things, I'm sure you'd be able to show that that pattern has been reversed in the modern era, and that these days you actually find emptiness being referred to quite a lot by Theravadan teachers as being a regularly understood concept and way of understanding things in Buddhism, and this being a kind of a development under the influence of things like Zen and Tibetan Buddhism and so on, which many people in the West are familiar with. So So this particular sutta is very interesting because it shows you how this treatment on emptiness was found in the early suttas, and like so many others, ideas, the notions which later become very kind of abstract philosophies in the suttas are treated in a very pragmatic way. Now, I have here, this is just a bit of show and tell here. This is two really big, thick, fat, heavy books with lots of footnotes and stuff in them. And this is Peter Skilling's first two volumes of his Mahasutras. Actually, there's a third volume, and which should be published by now. We should actually check on the Pali Text Society. Actually, that's one thing that we should have. The third volume actually has the translations. Mahasutras is a collection of sutras, texts found in the Tibetan canon, which are all Agama sutras. So these texts are all sutras which are sort of more or less collected together in the Tibetan collection, and most of which have parallels in Pali, and those few which don't have parallels in Pali also have parallels in the Chinese. So they're from the early period of Buddhism. So this is like the single largest collection of early Buddhist texts found in the Tibetan canon. And it includes such sutras a list of them is the Maya Jala, the Net of Illusion, which is a fascinating sounding sutra. There's no Pali parallel to that, but there is a Chinese one. And then there's a Bimbisara Pratyudgamana Sutra, which is the story of Bimbisara, and this is doesn't have a direct parallel in the Pali, but the stories of Bimbisara are found in various places in the Vinaya and other places. Then the Sunyata Sutra, which is this one, the Mahasunyata Sutra, which is the next one in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Dajaga Sutta, which is found in Sanghita Nikaya. There's two versions of that in Tibetan. There's the Panchataya, which is another Majjhima Nikaya Sutta, which we'll come to soon. Mahasamaja Sutra, which is the Mahasamaya Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. Ardhanatiya, which is the Ardhanatiya Sutta, also in the Digha Nikaya. The Arya Vaishali Pravesha Sutra, which doesn't seem to have a Pali corresponding sutra. So these ones, and now that's not many out of the thousands of suttas in the Pali canon. That's not a huge amount, but that's most of the ones. There are some other suttas which do have parallels in Tibetan, but that's actually the biggest single collection of them. So you can see that there's actually not that many, but they're excellently studied, collected. This one has the text in Tibetan and Pali. Just written Pali texts. This one has a study of them, and the third volume has the translations. So that's well worth having a look at if you're interested in the early suttas. By Peter Skilling.
So that's the
right. No, he's translating them. What?
No, I mean, is this a decent sort of like equivalent or...
No, it's not translating from Tibetan to Pali. Oh. It's giving the Pali edition and the Tibetan. The Pali and Tibetan.
Oh,
yeah. So this is by Peter Skilling, who's a scholar living in Bangkok. He actually came to visit Santi a few years ago. Let's begin with the Chula Sunyata Sutta, and the theme of the sutta is to talk about using a method. It's an unusual approach to meditation, which uses the notion of emptiness as a series of reflections for going progressively deeper and deeper into meditation. When we do this, I'm going to be I have Venerable Tanisaro's translation on the screen here, but I'm going to be reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, not Bhikkhu Bodhi's Tanisaro, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, and I'm going to do that just in order to keep all of us confused. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in the Eastern Park in the palace of Megara's mother. Then, by the way, I forgot to mention that this is the table of the corresponding suttas. The Pali here is the one we're going to be reading the translation. The Chinese version in the Madhyama Agama, so this is from the Sarvastivadin school, as most of the Majjhima Nikaya suttas have parallels in the Majjhima Agama, and this is the Tibetan edition giving with the details here. Peter Skilling says that the Tibetan one is a Sarvasivadin or Mulda Sarvasivadin text, so it's from a very similar lineage as these two. So we would expect that these two would be similar or identical in most instances. Okay, but as I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in the eastern park in the palace of Megara's mother. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Ananda rose from meditation, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Bhante, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country, where there is a town of the Sakyans named Nagaraka. Nagaraka meaning little city. Then, Venerable Sir, I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Now, Ananda, I often abide in emptiness, or voidness, as Nyanamoli translated it as, but I'll try to keep it as emptiness, in sunyata. Did I hear that correctly? Venerable Sir, did I learn that correctly? Did I attend to that correctly? Did I remember that correctly? So, one of the interesting little details about this sutta is that Ananda here is quoting, as happens frequently in the suttas, Ananda is quoting from a saying of the Buddha, which you would expect to find elsewhere in the suttas, yeah? Because he's saying, well, I've heard this elsewhere, but that saying doesn't in fact appear anywhere else in the suttas. And well, that's, you kind of expect these little quirkettes to happen from time to time in the redaction process. But the interesting thing about this little quirkette is that this is not just the case in the Pali canon, it's also the case even in the Sarvasivadin canon. And the fact of the absence of that became the subject of a debate in the Sarvasivadin school. Apparently the Vyakya Yukti, which is a Sanskrit Abhidhamma text, takes up the absence of a record of this saying to demonstrate that the sutra collection of the Shravakas is not complete, that it does not record every teaching given by the Buddha. Okay, oh sorry, the Vyakya Yukti, actually I'm not quite sure what that is. It may be a Mahayana text, actually. That's probably more likely. So I think this is an argument by the Mahayanists to say that the sutra collection of the Shravakas is not complete, without intending to, and then Analia goes on to say, without intending to dispute the incompleteness of the collection of discourses, it would nevertheless be noted that the argument in the present instance doesn't work too well. If the Buddha was given a full exposition of the matter on an early occasion, Ananda would not have needed to inquire about it again on the present occasion. This suggests that on the former occasion, the Buddha made only the short statement quoted in the present discourse. Such a short statement would then, due to its brevity, not have stood a chance to be recorded as a discourse on its own. And elsewhere also, when there's several statements where other monks, apart from the Buddha, declare that they dwell in emptiness, these are also not found on their own, but occur as part of a longer exposition. So Analia is making the point here that that such a short statement like that may have been just a remark that the Buddha said at one time or another, and so wasn't remembered as an independent sutta. So that's possible, but it is interesting that in the different collections, you know, to me the most interesting fact is simply the fact that little tiny little detail of transmission question is actually the same even in the completely different collections in the Pali and in the Sanskrit schools, even those little details were the same. And I should also just make this point, which I've made before, but I'll just make it again. Notice the text here, the beginning of the sutta, evam me sukang ekang samayang bhagava, which Venerable Tanisaro translates incorrectly. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying in Savatthi. And actually it should be according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was saying blah 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 blah. I have heard that on one occasion. Yeah? Because the phrase thus have I heard is an independent phrase which is quoted elsewhere. to mean that this is something which you've heard passed down through an oral tradition, or you've heard from hearsay. Notice here when Ananda is saying that he's heard something from the Blessed One's lips, he said, Bhagavato sammukha sutang sammukha patigahitang. Yeah? So this is something that I have heard in the presence of the Blessed One, sammukha sutang, sammukha patigahitang. I have grasped it and remembered it in the presence of the Blessed One. So this is the phrase that Ananda would use when he was referring to a teaching that he had heard from the Buddha himself. So the phrase evam me sutang, it doesn't mean that. Evam me sutang specifically means this is something that I have heard, that somebody has told me, but when I wasn't there. This is something which has been passed down by hearsay. So the tradition is that this is the word said by Ananda in the first council. But unfortunately that can't be correct, because he was in fact present at many of these sutras, and so he would have used this phrase here, sammukha sutang sammukha patigahitang. Yeah, so we know from other references in the sutras that evam me sutang specifically uses a phrase to say, well, this is what I've heard, this is what's been passed down, even though I wasn't there, but this is what I know about it. Because of the context that it's given. So, for example, one of the contexts is when the Venerable Anuruddha is talking about the devas or something to a layman, and he talks about them, and then the layman says, well, I notice that the Venerable Anuruddha doesn't say evam me sutang. Yeah? So therefore he must have been there and actually seen these devas himself. Yeah, so he's actually inferring from the fact that he doesn't, if he had used evam me sutang, then that would have meant, well, I wasn't there myself, but I heard it from someone else. But he didn't say that, therefore he must have been there himself. Exactly, yeah. So that's the specific, and it's an independent phrase, that's why this translation, I have heard that on one occasion, isn't correct, because this evam me sutang by itself is an independent phrase. Now, grammatically you can construe it either way, but that occurs as a little thing by itself. Okay, so come back to the sutta. Okay, so this is the Ananda asks the Buddha about this particular teaching, and the Buddha replies, yes, Ananda, you heard it correctly. You learned that correctly, attended to that correctly, and remembered it correctly. As formerly too, Ananda, so now I often abide in emptiness. Yes?
And this is an omni reflection.
Uh-huh.
Is that saying I'll fully?
Remain fully, yeah. Okay. Where is it? Sunyata. Where? Sunyata? Emptiness? Yeah. Viharena. Okay. Aham. Ananda. Etarhi. Now. Presently. Often abide. Now, Ananda, I often abide in emptiness. And then when he replies it, he says, and then in the reply he says, Pubbe paham. Both formally and presently, I often abide in emptiness. Yeah. So, what does Sunisra say? I now remain fully in a dwelling of emptiness. And now remain fully. Ah, he's using bahulang to mean fully rather than frequently. Yeah, remain fully. Bahulang viharati, yeah. So the difference in the translation is that bahulang usually means frequently. Yeah. Why? It's actually a very different translation, because if you take Tanisro's translation literally, then that means that when the Buddha was talking to Ananda, he was actually in that attainment of emptiness while he was talking to Ananda. Yeah. Whereas in Bhikkhu Bodhi's one, it's like saying, oh, you know, this is a kind of meditation which I'm doing, you know, often at the time. So yeah, it's quite a different meaning, but I think Bhikkhu Bodhi's is correct. Yeah, it's more, certainly it's more simple. But I mean, Tanisra might have had a reason for saying fully, for bahulang, rather than frequently, but normally it certainly means frequently. Yeah, and this being one of the reasons why I always prefer the Bodhi's translations. Yeah. But yeah, okay. Okay, Ananda, and then he goes on to say detail how that meditation goes. Ananda, just as this palace of Megara's mother is void, so the palace of Megara's mother, of course, being the large building which was offered by Visakha to the Sangha in Savatthi, just as this palace of Megara's mother is void of elephants, cattle, horses and mares, void of gold and silver, void of the assembly of men and women, and there is present only this non-voidness, namely the singleness dependent on the Sangha of bhikkhus. So to a bhikkhu not attending to the perception of village, not attending to the perception of people, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of forest. His mind enters into that perception of forest and acquires confidence, steadiness and resolution. He understands thus, whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of village, these are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of people, these are not present here. There is present only this amount of disturbance, that is the singleness dependent on the perception of forest. He understands this field of perception is void of the perception of village, this field of perception, I'll try to mentally retranslate the void here to emptiness or empty. This field of perception is empty of the perception of people. There is present only this non-emptiness, that is the singleness or unification or unity dependent on the perception of forest. Thus he regards that it of empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus. This is present. Thus, Ananda, this is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into emptiness. And I'll just go on to look at another couple of cases. The meditation then continues, just so you get an idea of the pattern of it. Again, Ananda, a bhikkhu not attending to this perception of people, not attending to the perception of the forest, attends only to the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. His mind enters into that perception of earth and acquires confidence, steadiness and resolution. Just as a bull's hide becomes free from folds when fully stretched with 100 pegs. So it's a very vivid image there. So too, a bhikkhu, not attending to any of the ridges and hollows of this earth, to the rivers and ravines, the tracts of stumps and thorns, the mountains and uneven places, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. His mind enters into that perception of earth and acquires confidence, steadiness and resolution. He understands thus, whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of people, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of forest, those are not present here. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. He understands this field of perception is empty of the perception of people. This field of perception is empty of the perception of forest. There is present only this non-emptiness, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. Thus he regards that as empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present. Thus this is present. Thus and under this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into emptiness. Again, Ananda, a bhikkhu not attending to the perception of forest, not attending to the perception of earth, attends to the emptiness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space. His mind enters into that perception of the base of infinite space and acquires confidence, steadiness and resolution. He understands thus, whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of forest, these are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of earth, these are not present here. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space. He understands this field of perception is void of the perception of forest. This field of perception is void of the perception of earth. There is present only this non-emptiness, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space. Thus he regards it as empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present. Thus this is present. Thus Ananda, this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into emptiness. So I'll just break off there. The text continues with a variety of other meditations. So this is one of those suttas, as well as being of philosophical interest and so on, which kind of skips over all of the simple meditations that you and I might spend most of our time doing, and sort of goes sort of leapfrogs straight into some of the most profound meditation attainments. which sort of gives a suggestion of the profundity of this concept of emptiness. So, but there's a number of things which is very interesting to see and to understand about this passage. I mean, the first and most obvious thing is how the notion of emptiness is a relative idea. So the Buddha is not postulating the notion of emptiness as an abstract thing. He's not saying there is this kind of thing which is emptiness. Yeah. So he's not talking about it as a philosophical notion. He's talking about it as a relative concept. So things are things are empty of other things. Yeah. So the glass is empty of water. So this is important to remember, that emptiness shouldn't be treated as a kind of absolute, or emptiness is not when you hear about it talked sometimes in Buddhism, it's as if emptiness is some kind of metaphysical entity or something like that, whereas that's not how the Buddha talks about it at all. Certainly also it's not how Nagarjuna talks about it. So it's just used as a pragmatic concept to say it's empty of some things. And what is it empty of? Well, it's empty of the things which are causing disturbance, the things which are causing dukkha, yeah, for the meditator. So initially, those things are the straightforward, the things like the distractions of the village. Yeah. So when you go into the forest, and you say, well, this forest is actually empty of the distractions of the village. It's empty of the noise. Oh, no, don't have the noise of all those elephants like you hear in Bundanoon all the time. And it's actually a very simple and very beautiful thing to contemplate. Yeah. And when you go into the forest, then that's what you can use this as a very practical meditation. So when you go back to your kuti and so on, well, this is empty of everything. Say if we go into town this afternoon, we can go to Bowerall and so on. Then when we return to the monastery, then we can reflect. This is now empty of all of those things that we saw in the city. Yeah, we left all those things behind, so it's peaceful because of that. And so what you're showing you're training your mind to see that. When all of those things are not there, then those disturbances are not there. Yeah. So all of those things in the city or the village are disturbances. What's the word he's using for disturbance here? Is dharata. Yeah, dharata. Yeah, stresses, if you like. So all of those stresses. So then you come back to the house. But then when you go back to your kuti, then again you leave all the stresses of the house behind. Well, there's not going to be any phones ringing. There's not been anybody going to be asking you silly questions or anything like that. So you can go back to your kuti, and again, this is empty. There's those stresses, and so there's just all that's remained is this forest and all of those things around me in the forest. So this, and then when you go into sit into meditation, then even you can leave behind the forest, and you can leave behind all of those external things and come back into the mind. Now notice how here it moves from the perception of the wilderness to the perception of earth. And then when it uses the perception of earth, it has this very kind of striking simile of the hide, the bull's hide, stretched out. Yeah? So you can imagine that would be a familiar sight probably in a traditional country like India or something like that, that when the cows were killed, or when they died of natural causes or whatever, and the hide was being stretched out to make leather or something like that, yeah, skin, yeah, as in tiny kangaroo down sport, they tied me hide when I died, Clyde, and that's it hanging on the shed, yeah. So they tack it out and stretch it out so that they can, and the idea would be to remove any wrinkles from it, yeah? So that they would tack it out and stretch it free of wrinkles for making leather. So the same way you can develop this perception of earth, but if you're sitting in meditation, you can actually develop it as a meditation where you're perceiving the earth element, yeah? So remember the Buddha spoke about perceiving the earth element internally and the earth element externally, yeah? And that internal earth element is the hardness inside the body, bones, anything which is resistive and crunchy and firm is the earth element inside your body. And So then you also can develop that perception externally, yeah? So just using your imagination to imagine the earth. But this meditation is on the side of samatha, so it's on the side of a tranquility meditation, so that you perceive this earth as something single, yeah? So there's like a smoothness to it. And it's a kind of interesting that you know, saying don't perceive all of the roughnesses and details in the earth, but actually we know from from modern science and modern astronomy that actually if you look at the earth from outer space, that actually the size of the mountains and so on compared to the size of the earth is actually incredibly smooth. So if you actually perceive the earth is actually smoother than a billiard ball, yeah, even though it looks like it's very rugged and rough from our perspective, actually, relatively, according to the size of it, it's actually very smooth. So you make your perception big like that. Don't pay attention to all the details, but just to that earth. And so this is something that you can attain, as it says, to attain singleness based on the perception of earth. And that means to attain jhana based on that. So you develop a nimitta. The nimitta which you develop, so originally when you develop your perception of earth, it will have details in it, but when the nimitta becomes purified, all of those details will be left out, and that's the process which is described in the Visuddhimagga, talking about developing the earth kasina meditation. We've talked about that earlier, but if you remember in that discussion, talked about how the initial perception of earth has flaws in it. And it's only later that it's developed so it's completely free of any flaws. And so that's, this is a similar process here.
What are the Pali dreams of
meditation? This one. Here we go. Is that, in that perception of earth, tassa patavi sanyaya chittam, in mind pakkhandati, leaps forward, enters into it, pasidati, yeah, so acquires pasada, or becomes pasaded, becomes tranquil, clear, confident, glad, santiptati, becomes steady, so that's the stillness of it. And adhimuchati. No, adhimuchati means confident. Adhimuchati is generally it's a synonym for sadha. Yeah. Even though it's from the root mokha, meaning to be released. So it has that kind of thing, but I think it's the idea is that it's released onto the object. It becomes confident in it because it's just free of any doubts. So that's important to notice that sentence, because this is essentially talking about how your emotional response is to that meditation. So it's not just a dry meditation that you're doing, but it's one in which the mind enters towards and moves into, becomes one with. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Okay, so any questions on that so far? No? Okay. Now I might just take a break from reading further in the sutta to have a look at Venerable Anālaya's comparative study. In the comparative study we're going to be looking at these three we've been reading so far from this particular version, the Pali version, and we're going to be looking at how this compares with these other two versions. Okay. For the what, sorry? Ananda asked the Buddha if this was the teaching that he said. Yeah, the sutra itself doesn't give any more background than that. Yeah. Okay. So both all of the three versions begin with Ananda inquiring if he's rightly remembered an early occasion the Buddha proclaimed that he dwelled in emptiness, and the Buddha confirmed and then went on to explain it, so all of those versions are the same. In relation to the various steps to be taken during the gradual approach for such dwelling in emptiness, the Chula Sunyata Sutta and its parallels propose a similar mode of contemplation. This contemplation is based on developing a unitary type of experience, followed by considering this experience as devoid of the disturbances relating to the kind types of perception that at this stage have been left behind. The three versions instruct to contemplate what is present as existing and at the same time as empty of what has been left behind, and conclude that in this way a genuine and undistorted approach to emptiness can be developed. So in this respect, all of the versions are similar. Analio has some discussion of the specific phrasings and terminology used in different cases, and with allowance for translation issues, there doesn't seem to be any particularly significant variations here. The word pure, which we find in the Pali, undistorted and pure, parisuddha, that word doesn't have a parallel in the Chinese and Tibetan versions. The list of things that are that it's empty of, the village, the elephants, and all of those things, that list is somewhat more lengthy in the Chinese versions. There's more things missing on the Tibetan version. The Tibetan version is the longest. Yeah. Okay. So just some minor differences in phrasing there. Okay, so according to all three versions, the Buddha began his exposition by highlighting the absence of any animals, possessions, or human beings except for the community of monks in the forest where the discourse was taking place. The Chinese and Tibetan versions, in other words, not the Pali, turn to the presence of the Sangha as the first step in the gradual approach to emptiness, presenting it in the same manner as all the subsequent steps of practice in the gradual meditation on emptiness. The Chinese and Tibetan versions then proceed to the perception of the forest, which thus forms the second step in the meditative development of emptiness in their versions. The Pali version, however, does not reckon awareness of the monk community as a stage in itself, as it immediately continues by directing attention to the perception of the forest. So this is a little quirk, if you notice, in the Pali version. So it starts here by saying, I now dwell in emptiness, just as this palace of Megara's mother is empty of elephants, cattle, and so on, so on, so forth. And here there is only the singleness based on the community of monks. So then even so, yeah, then continuing, a monk not attending to the perception of village or the perception of human being attends to the singleness based on the perception of wilderness. So if it went according to the pattern found in every other paragraph, it would then go to the perception singleness based on the perception of the Sangha. Yeah? And then take another paragraph and then go from the Sangha to the wilderness or to the forest. But in the Pali version, that seems to be skipped out. But the Tibetan and Chinese versions have that pattern which follows, as you might expect, in all the other versions. Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. But in every other way, okay, we've got human being, wilderness. Attending perception of human being, not perception of the wilderness. It tends to the perception of earth. Yeah, look, maybe. Yeah, I mean, that's how I'd read it previously. But then seeing as the Chinese and Tibetan do have that. Yeah, there isn't. That's a good point. There's no meditation on the bull's hide as such. Yeah. Okay. The step that follows the perception of the forest and the gradual meditation on emptiness described in the Chula Sunyutta and its parallels requires developing a unitary perception of the earth by not giving attention to such things as valleys, mountains, etc. And as well as the negative method by the Pali, which says don't pay attention to the valleys and mountains and so on and so forth, the Tibetan and Chinese version also add a positive aspect to that, saying that the meditating monk gives attention to the perception of sameness, like they were looking at the palm of their hand. Yeah? So you're looking, in other words, when you're looking at the earth, you're not looking at the things that differentiate the earth, right? You're not looking at this is rock and this is sand and this is desert and this is mountain and so on, but you're looking at the sameness, which is what's common to all of that, right? Which is the earth element, yeah? It's that aspect of the hardness of it. So you're looking at the sameness of things rather than the difference of them. Sameness, in fact, being a translation of the word samatha.
So there's no need to go into the other.
In this particular meditation, yeah, it doesn't mention that. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't think it's meaning to exclude them, but yeah, it doesn't mention them in this case. Yeah. Okay. So Anada goes on to note that the perception of that the idea of fixing a ox hide and stretching it out and so on is similar to a simile used elsewhere to describe the tortures which are visited upon the sufferer in hell. So, same simile in different contexts. Okay. In this discussion here, it doesn't specifically mention that when developing the perception of earth, that the meditator goes into jhanas. Okay, it doesn't actually mention anything. It says the singleness, and the word ekata, usually implying jhana, but it doesn't actually say that, and it's not kind of explicit. But then it goes on to talk about the infinite space and infinite consciousness and so on and so forth, and so clearly it obviously does mean to imply that through the perception of earth, that you're developing the jhanas, because only based on the jhanas can you go to the immaterial attainments. This actually is a very common shorthand which you find in the suttas and which you want to bear in mind, that when it talks about developing the perception of the four elements, in this case it's only the earth element, but often it might be the earth, water, wind and fire elements, that often that's suggested or implied in there that it's actually meaning to develop a jhana based on those things. And this is an idiom which is actually found in quite a few contexts. It's a bit similar to, say, the development of Brahma Viharas, where the Buddha often would just say, you know, you develop metta or something like that. But actually, if you look in context, you can see he's actually talking about developing the jhana, which is based on those things. So in that case, the jhana would be based on that very pure and unified nimitta, which is the purified perception of earth. So it's just a very simple perception, and then that allows the mind to go to absorption. Right. Yeah. And I mean, this is one of those passages, even though the full description of the development of the jhana in the Visuddhimagga is not found in the suttas, but descriptions like this one do seem to be a similar kind of thing. Another interesting detail of this sutta is that even though sunyata, or emptiness, is generally considered to be one of the aspects developed under insight meditation. So emptiness is often considered to be a synonym of not-self, which is part of the development of vipassana, or insight. But in this case, it's used to develop samatha, so to develop tranquility. So this is another one of those things which show that you can't really separate the notions of samatha and vipassana.
So if you consider the earth element in the body,
yep,
the sameness would be what? Just considering the body as a whole?
Not just considering the body as a whole, but considering the earth element without noticing the details and the differences between the different aspects of the earth element. Yeah?
It's there, but you...
So, for example, you know, when you first contemplate the body, you might see like the nails and bone and teeth and the hardness of the muscles and organs and so on. But then, as the contemplation goes on, you just see the earth element. You don't see those different things. Yeah. And similarly, with the comparing the internal and external, like originally you see this is mine and it's different from the earth element out there, but as you continue, you begin to realize actually it's just the earth element. Yeah.
Right. So different states of matter.
Yeah.
So different states, so would earth element?
Of course, yeah. Ice is earth element, yeah. I mean, the earth elements, the elements as it talks about in this kind of way, they're not things, yeah? I mean, earth element is not earth,
yes.
but they're better to be considered like states of matter. So basically, you know, earth, fire, and water is earth, air, and water is solid, liquid, gas, yeah, and the fire element is the element of change. So it's what changes, yeah. But that's what changes water from liquid to solid to gas is the heat, yeah, which essentially is, when you come down to it, is just motion. Yeah? So it is interesting, even though it is interesting in Buddhism, because even though I don't like to kind of push these parallels between Buddhism and science too much, but if you look at the way this notion of elements is treated in the ancient world, yeah, it's not actually normal, or you don't find it always that it's the case that there's earth, water, fire. For example, in the Chinese system, you have wood, yeah, and hello.
You have metal.
come in. That's right. Yeah, you have like metal and wood, so it's like a less abstract system. Yeah, it's more based in the actual materials and less in the notion of the states of matter. So the Buddhist one is actually, you know, much closer to the modern scientific understanding of them. Yeah. But it doesn't take into account more exotic states like plasma and these kinds of things. Maybe. It's probably it's a fairly kind of exotic kind of thing.
Okay, did the Buddha or did he maybe did it somewhere?
Kalapas.
Kalapas.
Yeah, you have this notion of kalapas, but that's not found in the suttas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so kalapa means something like molecule, although it's not really the same as the molecules in modern chemistry, but it's not a dissimilar concept. Yeah, that's found in the later Abhidhamma development. Yeah. The notion of an atom as such is not found in the early suttas explicitly. It is found most of the later Buddhist traditions have a notion of an atom, which they call paramanu. And even the definition of an atom in most of the schools of Buddhism is actually similar. It's similar to different people have different definitions of it in Buddhism, but it's many of the schools of Buddhism, philosophical schools of Buddhism, regarded an atom as a concept, which is actually similar in modern science. Traditionally, we're told that sort of primary school understanding of an atom is this kind of smallest indivisible thing, yeah. But of course, we know from since the 19th century, we've known that actually an atom isn't a thing. An atom is a kind of a process of moving energies and so on. So you can't, in a sense, an atom isn't a
solid entity.
Yeah, it's not a solid entity, which is how it was always conceived in the West up until from the time of Democritus, who proposed it, up until the 19th century, and then it was realised that actually it was the notion of an atom is always dynamic and changing, so that our understanding, our treatment of it, in a sense, is a concept. Yeah. So an atom is a concept in the same way that, you know, like a group of people is a concept, because
yeah,
it's always changing. It's not to say it's not real, but it's just to say that it's just a word that we use to describe that changing thing. Yeah. So that's actually quite very similar to the Buddhist idea that you can break these things down, but you're not necessarily going to get to any level of final level of abstraction. Yeah. So okay, so then from the perception of earth, and it goes to the perception of space. Yeah. So space is what's there when there's no earth left behind. Yeah. So the classical description of this in the Visuddhimagga says that you have the nimitta, and then you take the nimitta away, and your mind just is aware of what's there when there's no earth, and that's space. There are some places where it actually talks about this infinite space as being like a perception of actually like the cosmos, like your mind actually goes out and perceives the outer space as in space. But generally speaking, the notion of space is simply the notion of the absence of anything else. So this is why it's brought in here, because it's all of these meditation attainments are dependent on the non-existence, the absence of what came before. And so this is in this way the treatment of emptiness in this particular sutta is very much in line with the way that the meditation attainments are always talked about in early Buddhism, where you have a particular state which is characterized by certain things being present and certain things being absent. And at each stage, you let go of more and more and more things. So if you look, for example, at the jhana formulas, which is not mentioned in this particular sutta, but the four jhanas, you know, the first jhana has five factors, vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. Then second jhana, we leave off two of those factors, vitaka, vichara. Then the third jhana, we leave off another factor as piti. And then the fourth jhana, we leave off the sukha. So at each stage, more and more is dropping out. So the profundity and the depth of the meditation attainment is dependent on how many things are not there. Yeah? So how many things are left behind. So this is very important to understand. This is why when we're sitting in meditation, you know, you notice that even if long before we've reached profound levels of meditation like this, even in ordinary meditation, you know that when you're sitting and if your mind is full of things, if your mind is full of thoughts and full of emotions and full of ideas and all of these kinds of things, then it actually becomes very stressful. And when you let go of things, yeah, the mind goes quiet, thoughts, everything drops out, and that's so much more peaceful. So this is the basic message of this sutta, is that the emptiness, when the mind is empty, all of those things gone, then there's so much more peaceful. Okay, so from the base of infinite space, it then goes on, as usual, to develop the base of infinite consciousness and the base of nothingness, and I won't talk about these specific attainments too much in detail because we've discussed them earlier. Okay, and actually I'll come back to the sutra and just read through passages from here. Okay, so resuming the reading of the sutta. Here, bhikkhu not attending to the perception of earth or the perception of the base of infinite space attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite consciousness. His mind enters into that, acquires confidence, steadiness and resolution. He understands thus, whatever disturbances that might be dependent on the perception of earth, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances that are dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space, those are not present here. Present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite consciousness. He understands this field of perception is empty of the perception of earth and the perception of the base of infinite space. There is present only this non-emptiness, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite consciousness. He regards it as empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus, this is present. Thus, and under this too, is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness, into emptiness. From the base of infinite consciousness, he then goes in a similar way to develop the base of nothingness, whatever disturbances that are present in the base of infinite consciousness, that dratted, disturbing old infinite consciousness, I can now leave that behind and go to that much more peaceful nothingness. And then he regards it as empty of what is not there, and what is still there, that is present. Okay, so then in this respect, all of the different versions are similar. The Pali version then goes on, unlike the Chinese and Tibetan version, the Pali version then goes on to talk about the fourth of the formless attainments, that is the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So similarly, by not attending to infinite consciousness or base of nothingness, enters into the base of singleness dependent on the perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. His mind enters into that, acquires steadiness and resolution, and he reflects in the same way that what is present is there and what is absent is not there. I'll come back to that in a moment. But then the next paragraph, it goes on, again, a bhikkhu enters into the base of not attending to any of those other formal perceptions of nothingness and infinite consciousness, nothingness and neither perception nor non-perception, attends to the singleness dependent on the signless concentration of mind. Okay, Venerable Tanisara has themeless concentration of mind and awareness, which is themeless. I don't really like it. Everybody else uses signless. His mind, this is animitta. His mind enters into that signless concentration of mind, and similarly, whatever dependences were present before, those are not present here. But then it goes on to have a little bit of a variation. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely that connected with the sense faculties that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. Okay, so whereas previously he said that there's what is present is only the singleness of dependent on the perception, so there's only that unity of the samadhi experience, and now he's reflecting that there is the disturbance connected with the six bases, the six faculties that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. This field of perception is void of all of those others, and he regards it as being void of what is not there, empty of what is not there, and what is there he understands as being present thus. So dependent on this very body of life as a condition. Okay, and then again Ananda, again slightly curious this next one, and different in the Pali and Chinese versions. Again, bhikkhu not attending perception of the base of nothingness, or neither perception nor non-perception, attends to the singleness dependent on the signless concentration of mind, which we just had in the previous paragraph. So if you look in the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, paragraphs 10 and 11 start out the same way. The Chinese and Tibetan don't do this. His mind enters into the signless concentration of mind again, and acquires steadiness and so on. Then he understands this signless concentration of mind is conditioned and dependently is fabricated and mentally fashioned, by which he doesn't mean that it was sewn up in the local shop. It means Bhikkhu Bodhi has this is conditioned and volitionally produced. Okay, in other words, this is produced by conditions. This is not something which is unconditioned, so it's not nibbana, no matter how profound and peaceful that these meditation attainments are, they are still conditioned and thus impermanent. Whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent and subject to cessation. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the defilements of sensual desire, being, and ignorance, or rebirth and ignorance. When he's liberated, there comes the knowledge. It's liberated, he understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. So he begins, so in this way, he develops, here he's explicitly developing insight based on the that signless concentration. So notice that when the signless concentration in these two paragraphs, the first one it says that the emptiness or the non-emptiness is connected with the six senses dependent on this body with life as its condition. So here, by acknowledging the six senses and the body and so on, and that this is dependent on these things, it's starting to go to that side of being an insight contemplation, a vipassana contemplation, as compared to the earlier ones where it's purely just looking at the singleness of these things. So this being the samadhi one. So this is this signless concentration, animitta, is signals the shift over to vipassana or to insight. And then that's made much more explicit here, where it's just contemplating the conditionality and then the impermanence of these things. And this is precisely what vipassana is. This is the essence of vipassana, is the contemplation of things as impermanent and conditioned. So this signless concentration is associated with the shift from samatha to vipassana. Which then raises the question of exactly what signless means. And this is, of course, quite an interesting topic, one which has been sort of studied quite a lot in modern studies of this, but also treated in the traditional commentaries and so on. And what the signs that are absent are described in different ways in different contexts, but In this case, you'd probably say the sign is perhaps the sign of permanence. So you could say the sign of permanence is absent. Okay, but the point here is that nimitta, what we're translating as sign, okay, what it's really getting at and how it's used in Pali, the nimitta or the sign of things, really it's referring to, think of a nimitta as a, first thing to understand, I'm not being very coherent here, I need another cup of coffee. First thing to understand is that nimitta means, can mean a sign as in like a street sign. Okay, so nimitta here doesn't mean nimitta as in the samadhi nimitta which we talked about earlier. Okay, this is a different meaning of the word nimitta in vipassana. So it's like a street sign, or even better, a brand mark. Okay, so remember how I mentioned that in the Tibetan tradition they talk about the four seals. Yeah, so the four marks, right? And that these things shift your perception. Now imagine you go into a shop and there's two sets of shoes. One of them has the Nike swoosh on them, and the other one has a swoosh which says, I'm generic Chinese knockoff, right? Now, in fact, both of these shoes came out of the same factory. They're exactly the same thing, right? And somebody stuck a Nike swoosh on one of them and stuck a generic Chinese ripoff on the other, right? But the sign that's on that makes you perceive it differently, yeah? You see, this one, I'm paying for the Nike, so I'm going to pay a premium on that. Which you might do because you're an idiot, or you might do because, well, you think at least I get to impress people by having some Nike shoes, so you might actually have a reason for it, right? But you can see how that the presence or absence of that sign is what actually shifts your perception, the way that you see that thing. And this is precisely what it's meaning when it's talking about the sign of things in this way, and the signless concentration. So instead of actually seeing things through that filter of perception, yeah, you're removing the sign from it. So you think of it in a way like it's a process. Again, you could compare it to, say, doing double blind tests in science, right? Where you remove you don't know who it is that you're talking to. So the data or whatever it is that comes through in a way that's very pure, there's no signs attached to anything, so you can consider it very objectively. This is what it means when it's talking about signless, is that so you're not seeing things in terms of your past experience, your preferences, favouring and opposing, or anything like that, but just seeing things in a way that's very naked, very bare, and just seeing it very objectively. This is essentially what it's talking about with the signless concentration.
Talking about seeing is just...
Basically, yeah. Sorry?
Concentrate on sign. The sign is something.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And signing something makes a significance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So is it the same stage
actually? No, that's a different one.
So
yeah.
What's the difference? That one actually is this one.
Ooh, yeah, yeah. Cessation of perception and feeling is, again, it's a very kind of subtle thing. But this one, it's never really described in a lot of detail in the suttas. But it seems to me that what it's referring to here is a kind of vipassana samadhi, yeah? A kind of an insight contemplation which is happening, it's emerging from all of those samatha meditations. So now it's turning to more of a contemplative vipassana style meditation. Whereas the cessation thing is more in the line of a samatha thing, it's just a continuation of the emptying of everything.
So this is your...
At this point I would say so, yeah. But it's also considered to be a kind of samadhi, yeah. So it's not just sort of sitting there thinking, oh yeah, things are signless and they don't have, it's not permanent, right? It's still quite a deep state of samadhi, but it's a post-jhana state of insight samadhi.
What they call upachara?
No, it's not. Word upachara has come up in a different context, and sometimes it is used in that way. But the word upachara more characteristically means that state which is immediately before the jhana. It is. That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's true. It is used in that context as well, yeah. There's no nimitta either in the sense of having a bright light in your meditation, nor is there a nimitta in this sense of being a sign on anything. This is after all that. That's what you've already been through, all of that stuff. You let go of all that stuff, yeah. The nimitta as such, we'll come to you down in a minute, is that would be let go of when you go into, that's this distinction between the four jhanas and the formless attainments. When you go into the formless attainments, the first one is the base of infinite space. So if your nimitta is here, so I have a happy, you can have a happy face or an angry face nimitta, and so you know that's then your object of samadhi. But then based infinite space, you sort of that's absent already. So you're saying the absence of that nimitta. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So mindfulness becomes even more pronounced in those states. Yeah. Yeah, but that's the difference here with this last one is the neither perception nor non-perception, and at that stage things are starting to get so out there that you're not even quite aware in the same sense of what we normally call awareness. So they call it neither perception nor non-perception, and this is actually one where there's an ambiguity in the text, how they treat that, which I'll come to in a moment. But, Dana, you had another question? Right, yeah.
No logic, it's just seeing the conditionality and the emptiness.
Absolutely, yeah.
There is no internal response in the house.
Yeah.
It's just been blowing through.
And look, and it can actually feel quite like that. You know, you can feel like that in, you know, when you're doing insight, you feel like your body just becomes empty. It's just like the wind is just like blowing through you. And, yeah.
Jhanas.
Hmm.
And it's in the zone.
Uh-huh.
Yep. And then his mind presses onto his signs more.
Right.
In sense that, yep. You know. And then so it's fit. Doing insight.
Yeah, but it's not like ready to do insight in the sense of ready to sit down there and start thinking. I'm going to start contemplating impermanence and looking at the five khandhas. But in this kind of presentation, you know, the insight like just emerges from that whole thing. It's like a natural emergence from that whole process. The state of insight at these very advanced stages, the state of insight and the state of samadhi. The difference between them starts to evaporate. So it's the point I was trying to make earlier, when it starts to bring in the animita, that it naturally shifts over from one to the other. So it's not like you're now doing, you would now start doing a vipassana meditation, okay? So doing a vipassana meditation is something you do at the start of practice if you want to develop that way, yeah? But this is something where your mind enters a state where that insight is literally kind of embodied in how the mind is.
So it's like
a convergence that the samatha and vipassana is like converging into those kind of states, and those distinctions don't really apply anymore at that level. Yeah, I mean it's very mysterious. It's hard to understand and describe, and I really do think when you get to this level, it's really something that you know you can just experience and see for yourself. But I think. Even though this very profound attainment, you know, is very very subtle, but still, I think we can get an idea of what that is like. Like if you do meditation, if you do like a samatha meditation, yeah, and then as you go through that, and then when your mind wants to come out of that, yeah, and then you can just look, and mind can be like completely still. And instead of looking at impermanence or contemplating this is impermanent, that's impermanent, or going through the five khandhas or something like that, there's just a stillness, and you just look, just the notion of impermanence or conditionality or something. It's just there. It's not a concept or anything like that, but it's just, the mind just sort of leaps towards it. So you have this kind of feeling or this perception of the bottom dropping away from things. Yeah. Yeah. So things are no longer solid, you know. Everything falls away. Yeah.
No, with that, the thing I don't understand is through these feelings.
You are, Tusita, when you go back to your kuti tonight, you're going to experience all of these things.
Isn't that sort of, it's say what I'm thinking. It sort of conflicts. It seems to conflict. I'm obviously wrong, but in my mind, it seems to conflict. There's some like feelings, but who is that someone? Where is that someone?
There isn't anybody feeling.
Right. But who realize? When you say realize, it comes from the person.
No, you don't.
No. You delineate boundaries instead of realize.
No, it's just there's a realization. But at that point, you're not sitting there and thinking, oh, this is my realization. It's just a realization.
So therefore, you find a stopping.
Yes, there is a stopping.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Nita, emptiness is very closely connected to the notion of not-self. In fact, elsewhere it's identified with it. Okay, I'm going to continue on. Okay, so the gradual approach. So I'm now going to read from Venerable Anālaya's essay. The gradual approach to emptiness thus progresses through the types of perception that correspond to the first three of the four immaterial attainments. And so here we're talking about the common ground between the Pali, Chinese, and Tibetan versions. Each time the respective experience is contemplated in the following manner: as empty as what is not there, and as not empty of what is there. According to the Chula Sunyata Sutta and its parallels, in this way it becomes possible to develop a genuine and undistorted meditative entry into emptiness. And it is noteworthy that it uses this word undistorted for meditation into emptiness, even at the preliminary stages of the meditation. So that they are, it's not as if they're a kind of false emptiness, even though they're not complete, but they are undistorted. Okay, the Pali version next takes up the attainment of neither perception nor non-perception, which is not found in the Chinese and Tibetan versions. And Anālaya here has a table which gives the what the different steps, slight differences in the steps. And as I noted at the beginning, because the Chinese and Tibetan versions come from the same or similar school, that they are much more similar compared to the Pali. All of the versions have the signless concentration of the mind and the as the last step.
Is that then when you feel practically as if you're floating?
No. Floating feeling is a feeling of piety. Rapture.
No.
Okay. Now. So for some reason that discussion's been taken out. Anālaya in a previous version of this essay had a long discussion of this difference. Why the Pali has the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and the other two don't. But it's a kind of long and complex and somewhat inconclusive discussion, which may be why he's removed it. But in any case, simply to note that in the suttas, when the four formless attainments, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception, when these are presented straightforwardly in a meditation context, they're usually almost always presented as the four. However, there are a number of cases where you just have the first three, infinite space, infinite consciousness, and nothingness, and based on neither perception nor non-perception is omitted. And those cases tend to be cases where they're treated in terms of developing insight. And it's sometimes said in the Pali commentaries and other places that the base of neither perception nor non-perception is simply too subtle to be used by most people as a basis for insight. And I think it says something like that only Buddhas and chief disciples or something like that can develop insight on the basis of that attainment because of its extreme subtlety. So there is some ambiguity found throughout the suttas as to this final attainment. And so that's reflected in this particular case where as we're moving from the samatha to the vipassana side, the base of neither perception nor non-perception is omitted from the Chinese and Tibetan versions, but it is found in the Pali. In that particular case, I would suspect that it was more likely to have been added to the Pali rather than to have been omitted from the other versions, but it's a bit difficult to say which one is correct. Anālaya has a lengthy note on the Animitta Samadhi, which I'll try to summarize the important parts of it for you. The Chinese translation, in fact, actually has a term rather than animitta, but would be more literally translated as an unconscious concentration of the mind. So the which used to is similar to the notion of the asanya sati, or asanya samapati, which is found referred to occasionally, the non-percipient of meditation attainment, which is found occasionally mentioned in these texts. But elsewhere, the Chinese seems to be a bit ambiguous, and since the Pali and the Tibetan have the signless, it seems very likely that the original is in fact the signless concentration of mind, not the unconscious concentration of mind. And Analia notes that it may have arisen from a confusion in the particular Chinese character, which there are other instances of those characters being confused. Okay, and he then goes on to discuss the notion of the signless meditation. A sign in these contexts refers to the aspects and marks and characteristics by which one recognizes phenomena. So the closeness of sign and recognition is a connection with the notion of sanya, or perception, which is that aspect of recognition of things. So notice again, like that example that I mentioned of the shoes, if you have the shoes with the Nike swoosh and the ones without it, you recognize the Nike one, yeah? Because you have a past experience, and so you notice that sign. Okay, speak of an unsurpassable... there are a couple of suttas in the Majjhima and Sanyutta that refer to the unsurpassable liberation of the mind as the highest of all signless experiences. So that's relating signlessness to arahantship. According to another couple of suttas in the Sanyutta, the animitta samadhi, the signless samadhi, is a path leading to the unconditioned. A couple of an Anguttara Sutta relates the signless concentration to the removal of greed, hatred and delusion. So this is another explanation that you sometimes find, is that the sign means the sign of greed, the sign of hatred, the sign of delusion. And Anguttara Nikaya takes up the case of a monk who dwells in signlessness in the context of discussion of various noble disciples. So dwelling in signlessness is an attainment of the enlightened ones. To be able to practice signless concentration of the mind, however, does not necessarily imply a high level of realization. Since another sutra in the Anguttara describes the case of a monk who, priding himself on having attained the signless meditation experiences, neglects seclusion and excessively associates with others, as a result of which his mind deteriorates and he disrobes. So signlessness is, this is one of the problems in trying to understand it, is it means different things in different contexts. In some places it's clearly identifying signlessness with arahantship, but in other cases it's clearly referring to a temporary state of meditation from which one can deteriorate. I'm not sure if he's bragging it about. Look, I'm not sure. It's possible, yeah, but I don't think so. I think it's just used in different ways in different contexts. Yeah. An additional perspective on signlessness can be found in a discourse in the Sanyukta Agama, according to which it's not possible to develop signlessness without having developed, in its ultimate sense, without developing concentration on emptiness. So that's something which you don't find in the Pali. Having attained emptiness, it is possible to develop signlessness. A statement that particular sutta proceeds by explaining that without having attained emptiness, to develop signlessness is not possible. Quite curious. These various passages make it clear why signless concentration of the mind comes as the climax of the gradual development of emptiness described in the Majjhima, in the Chulasunyata Sutta and its parallels. Okay, so it's also said in the Pali tradition also makes the equation, it connects signless, rather than saying that you have to develop emptiness first and then signless, what the Pali tradition says is that they're according to different characters, that different characters will tend to approach insight or develop insight in different ways, and that they will emphasize or their mind will take as a basis for insight the three characteristics. So some will develop insight primarily as impermanent, some as suffering, and some as not self. Yeah, so those who develop insight into impermanence, that's what's called the animitta or the signless samadhi. Yeah? So that's the signless insight. Those who develop insight into suffering, it would develop what's called the apanahita samadhi, which is the undirected concentration. And the those who develop insight into not self will develop the sunyata samadhi, the emptiness concentration. Yeah? So there are these different ways of looking at it. So it's important. The important thing here is that when you read about these things or you hear about them, that you pay very careful attention to the context to know how it's being used in that particular place, because they are used in different ways in different contexts. Okay, three versions then go on to direct insightful contemplation to the conditioned and mentally fabricated nature of such signless concentration, while the Pali discourse instructs to contemplate this experience as impermanent and subject to cessation. The Chinese and Tibetan accounts recommend avoiding delight in relation to this attainment. Okay, so this bit here is slightly different. Rather than the impermanence, where we've got here, nothingness. Right, so rather than this line about the impermanence, the Chinese and Tibetan versions mention signless. That to avoid taking delight in that. I do not delight in this. Do not seek it. It is not suitable for me to be established on this. Okay. Right. Where are we now? Okay. So now, the other quirk that I already noted with the Pali discourse is that it has two paragraphs dealing with the signless concentration of the mind. The first one, it says that you develop signless concentration and then you reflect on the six sensory spheres, which is the non-emptiness of basically life and the body, and then to develop the impermanence in the second paragraph. Whereas in the Chinese and Tibetan versions mention the signless concentration only once, and then continue directly to develop insight to undertake in relation to that experience. So the Chinese and Tibetan version is perhaps a bit more economical. Some of the editors of the Pali have remarked that it looks a little bit like part of the Pali text has maybe been duplicated by accident, resulting in those two paragraphs. The Pali version also speaks twice of the only disturbance that remains at this stage, which is the continuity of the six sense spheres conditioned by the life faculty. The Chinese and Tibetan versions speak of the six sense spheres and the life faculty only once, as part of the retrospective knowledge after the defilements have been eradicated. According to all versions, insight contemplation undertaken in regard to the signless concentration of mind leads to the destruction of defilements, which the Pali and Tibetan versions qualify as an unsurpassable manifestation of emptiness. Ah, that's interesting. The Tibetan version is different from the Chinese. So in the previous ones we've had pure and superior, pure and undistorted, and at the end here we have superior and unsurpassed. Yeah, this entry into emptiness, which is superior and unsurpassed. And kind of interesting from the Tibetan perspective, because I don't think that really agrees with the Tibetan philosophy, where they have these very refined developments of emptiness, and this would probably, according to their system, be just one of the beginner's stages in developing the real understanding of emptiness. I'm not sure about that, but anyway, it's interesting that there's that slight difference between the Tibetan and Chinese versions. The Pali version then goes on to say, the final paragraphs, whatever disturbance there might be dependent on the defilement of sensual desire, these are not present here. Whatever disturbance present on the defilement of rebirth are not here, and the defilement on ignorance are not present. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely that connected with the six bases that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. Okay, so this is the phrase here which seems to have been perhaps copied in the earlier paragraph for some reason in the Pali. He understands this field of perception is empty of the defilements, of these various defilements, and there's only this non-voidness that connected with the six bases and dependent on conditioned by life. He regards it as void of what is not there, but as what remains there, he understands that which is present. Thus, this is present. Thus, Ananda, this is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness, supreme and unsurpassed. Ananda, whatever recluses and Brahmins in the past, so this, of course, stock phrase, recluses and Brahmins, samana brahmana, basically means religious practitioners. So whatever, or meditators. Whatever meditators in the past entered upon and abided in pure, supreme, unsurpassed voidness, all entered upon and abided in the same pure, supreme, unsurpassed voidness. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will enter it upon and abide in this supreme, pure, supreme, unsurpassed void, emptiness, all will enter upon and abide in this same pure, supreme, unsurpassed emptiness, and same for all of those in the present. Therefore, Ananda, you should train yourself, we will enter upon and abide in pure, supreme, unsurpassed emptiness. This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. There's a slight difference here between the Pali and the other two versions, which both, instead of saying the Samanas and Brahmanas, Chanisaro has translated contemplatives and priests, they say the all the Tathagatas. Okay, all the Tathagatas, all the Buddhas of the past, present and future. So that seems to be a little bit more persuasive in this particular context, because normally when it uses the phrase Samana Brahmana, it's a generic phrase used for all meditators, whether Buddhist or non-Buddhists. And typically the suttas are quite happy to say that the non-Buddhists might be practicing jhanas and various kinds of other things, but they won't say that they're practicing basically to arahantship, which is what this is talking about here. So perhaps seems more plausible that the Chinese and Tibetan version, having mention of Tathagatas here. The commentary even remarks that on this particular Pali commentary remarks that in this case Samana Brahmana just means the practitioners of Buddhism.
With the places in the body, the science of conscious here is sort of like near as Fletcher's film work.
So basically every kind of disturbance is gone from the defilements and so on, and all that's left is this. And this is gone. So that's why it fits very well in that second context.
Yeah.
Better than in the first one, yeah. So that there are a few points of difference. I mean, again, as always, when doing these comparative studies, you know, we need to keep reminding ourselves that actually we're dealing with very slight variants on the same text. It's clearly the same sutta, and the differences are extremely minor, and they certainly don't affect it in any practical way. And as usual, it's not possible to really make any prior assumptions about which one is more authentic or which one isn't. In this case, there seem to be a few editing glitches in the Pali, perhaps, and a few cases where the Chinese and Tibetan presentation looks a little bit more coherent. But of course, there's many cases where the opposite is true, and the Pali is more coherent compared to the other ones. So it's not really possible to make generalizations about that. You have to look at each context as it on its own. But in any case, they don't really affect the meaning of the sutta. And in fact, all of the basic teachings in the sutta, starting with the simple teachings on developing the perception of emptiness, right through to the very profound meditations on signlessness. These are presented in the same way in all the different versions. Right, any questions? This is the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the shorter discourse on emptiness. Yeah, Majjhima Nikaya 121. That's found in here, and this is when we're doing the comparative studies, we're using this book by Amalia. This is a book called A Comparative Study of the Majjhima Nikaya, and this was just released early in the year, or last year now, by Venerable Amalia. So this is a detailed academic study of the all these suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. And so this is a detailed study of all of those suttas in light of all the versions of those suttas in Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan and Chinese. Yeah. So in this case, there was a Sanskrit and Chinese version.
The science perception of earth before infinity soon, would actually be equanimity? Would that be the fourth term, equanimity?
Not necessarily. No, it would reach up. It would reach up as far as the fourth jhana, but it doesn't really distinguish. It just says that that perception of earth, which is has that idea of sameness to it, but actually that would encompass the, all of the four jhanas. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's certainly an aspect like equanimity in what you're saying, in that there's a sameness in the perception. Yeah. So that, yes, but actually there's equanimity even in first jhana.
Yeah.
I mean, even long before jhanas, you have to have a degree of equanimity, otherwise you can't even sit still for 5 minutes, right? So it's not as if equanimity is only in the third and fourth jhanas, but it comes to perfection there.
Yeah, it's strong.
It's strong, yeah. So as I said, here it's the earth. In many places it's the four elements, and it's used more or less as a shorthand or alternative way of presenting the first four jhanas. Yeah.
So it appears to me that just guides to the gradual sensation.
Exactly, yeah. And so, you know, these different words like emptiness or cessation or letting go and so on and so forth, you know, effectively pretty much mean the same thing, but just phrased. I mean, the tradition would say that they're phrased according to the different characteristics of people who need to be taught, that some people respond better to the teaching which is phrased in different ways. Yeah. Okay. So we will finish it up there. Have time for a little bit of a break. We'll be going to Barrel at leaving at 6:30. Yeah. So anyone wants to come out for some meditation in Om and Sachin's restaurant? Be ready at 6:30. There is aircon there. So if you want to come for a nice meditation, I'm sure they'll have a cool drink and some aircon. So if you want to come, most welcome. Yeah, so usually they're just a little, they have a little meditation group, and a few of the locals come along and we do a bit of metta meditation. So might be a bit of a break from this. Is a fairly intense sutta, so it's a bit of a break from that. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.